Greetings, everybody, to this Weber training teleclass. This is Elaine Larson. I'm have the privilege of introducing Lori Conway. Lori is a PhD candidate at Columbia University School of Nursing and a pre-doctoral fellow in the Center for Interdisciplinary Research to Reduce Infections. She holds a baccalaureate in nursing from the University of Western Ontario. She's been certified in infection control since 1999. She has a Master of Science in Clinical Research Management, as well as a postgraduate teaching certificate from the University of Maryland in Baltimore, where she subsequently joined the faculty at the University of Maryland Baltimore School of Nursing as a clinical instructor. Her research interests include the prevention of device-associated infections, the role and preparation of infection preventionists, and the role of organizational climate in healthcare-associated infection prevention. Lori's peer-reviewed publications have addressed guidelines for preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infection, adoption of policies to prevent CAUTI and surgical site infections in intensive care units in the United States, as well as the evolving role of the infection preventionist. Currently, she's examining the prevalence and predictors of bacteremia, which is secondary to catheter-associated UTI, in acute care hospitals. Her research is informed by a strong clinical background, also as an adult intensive care nurse. So let me turn it over now to Lori.
Thank you, Dr. Larson, for that introduction. I'm going to be speaking today about preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infections, so I'll call them CAUTI, in acute care settings among adults. And I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. Slide 2. Our primary objective today is to list essential strategies for preventing CAUTI in adults in, in acute care settings. So these strategies are most applicable to patients with short-term catheters, so those in for up to 14 days. And our secondary objectives are to compare and contrast CAUTI prevention guidelines, to describe the gaps in the current evidence base, to identify challenges in conducting CAUTI surveillance, and to relate CAUTI incidence to antimicrobial resistance. Slide 3. I'll divide the content of today's training into 7 parts. As background, I'll talk about CAUTI incidence and importance and definitions of CAUTI and pathogenesis. And then I'll get to the meat of the matter by reviewing CAUTI guidelines and strategies for prevention. Finally, I'll address challenges in surveillance for CAUTI and gaps in the evidence about CAUTI prevention. Slide 4. So let's start with incidence and importance. Slide 5. UTI are widely considered to be the most common healthcare-associated infection, or HAI, in hospitals. Menina Clevens and her colleagues estimated UTI rates using data from U.S. hospitals that was reported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention between 1990 and 2002. And they estimated that there are more than 560,000 UTIs each year in U.S. hospitals, and that for adults and children in ICUs, the rate of infection is 3.38 per 1,000 patient days. And that's not 3.38%. I apologize for that error in the slide. So the rate of infection is estimated at 3.38 per 1,000 patient days for children and adults in ICUs in the U.S. And they also estimated that UTI comprised about a third of all HAI. Now, most UTIs occur in patients with urethral catheters, and it's thought that about 80% of UTIs are catheter-associated, and that 25% of patients have a urinary catheter placed at some time during their hospital stay. Slide 6. There's a newer point prevalence study that's available, and it was done in 9 hospitals in Florida, and they found that UTI were not the most common, but the second most common HAI, and they suggested that UTI comprise about 15% of infections in U.S. hospitals. And as the authors know, the reduction compared to that earlier Clevin study might be because in 2009, asymptomatic bacteriuria was excluded from the definition of CAUTI used by the National Healthcare Safety Network. And I'm sure my listeners know that the National Healthcare Safety Network is a CDC body that collects and aggregates data about hospital infections and disseminates it so that hospitals can benchmark against a national rate. So I'll talk about various definitions of CAUTI later in the presentation, but I just want to mention now that when CAUTIs are counted, a distinction is not always made between symptomatic infection and asymptomatic bacteria in the urine. So we need to be aware of exactly what definition of CAUTI is used when rates are quoted. Slide 7. In the latest NHSN report, the pooled mean CAUTI rates in various types of adult units range from 0 to more than 4 per 1,000 catheter days. And the highest rates are in neurosurgical ICUs, burn ICUs and wards, and long-term rehab units, where the rate is 7.1 CAUTI per 1,000 catheter days. The device utilization ratio varies a lot according to what type of unit, from 3% to 7%. 70% of patients have catheters on any given day in different types of units. For instance, in trauma ICUs, the device utilization ratio is 0.79 urinary catheter days per patient day. And in long-term rehab units, the ratio is 0.07. So a lot of difference in how many catheters are used. Slide 8. For symptomatic UTIs, the rates in intensive care units may not be different from the rates in wards. And that has implications for surveillance. So David Weber and his colleagues examined the incidence of CAUTI and UTIs that are not catheter-associated in their healthcare system. And if you look at the table in column 4, you'll see that they found rates, CAUTI rates in step-down units and wards were similar to ICUs. For example, the medical ICU had a rate of 3.75 CAUTIs per 1,000 catheter days, and then medical step-down unit and ward had a rate of 3.17. They also found that CAUTI rates in rehab units are especially high at more than 10 infections per 1,000 catheter days. And also, as you can see in the second to last column, 27.8% of all UTIs in their healthcare system were not catheter-associated. Slide 9. So if we look internationally, CAUTI rates are somewhat higher. The International Nosocomial Infection Control Consortium, or INIC, data for 2004 to 2009 showed a pooled mean of 6.3 CAUTI per 1,000 catheter days. And compared to the U.S. at that time, ICUs at INIC hospitals had similar device utilization ratios, but their CAUTI rates were significantly higher, and they had more antimicrobial resistance, including methicillin-resistant Staph aureus and extended-spectrum beta-lactamase producers and Pseudomonas that was resistant to fluoroquinolones. Slide 10. Last year, Victor Rosenthal and his team reported a reduction in CAUTI in INIC hospitals after implementing a CAUTI prevention program. Hospitals in 40 cities in 15 countries participated, and they examined CAUTI rates in 57 adult ICUs before and after the intervention. Their multidimensional strategy included a large bundle of practices, some education, and surveillance with feedback. And by the way, every component of their practice bundle will be discussed today in the training. So their results, their CAUTI rates declined significantly from 7.86 to 4.95 infections per 1,000 catheter days. And returning to U.S. hospitals, slide 11, there's a temporal trend downward in CAUTI rates in U.S. hospitals. Data from 1990 to 2007 reported to NHSN and its legacy system, the NIST, in adult ICUs, including med-surg, medical, surgical, cardiac, and cardiothoracic ICUs, CAUTI rates have declined significantly. All types of units experienced significant declines in symptomatic CAUTI of between 19 and 26%, and most recently, between 2000-2007, all types of units except cardiothoracic ICUs experienced declines of 18 to 35%. So there are also declines in asymptomatic bacteriuria in all types of units, and the device utilization remained unchanged. Slide 12. Cowdy is associated with excess morbidity and cost to the healthcare system. Excess length of stay has been estimated as low as 1 to 2 days and as high as 12 days for ICU patients. And the incidence of secondary bacteremia is between 4 and 0.4%. So the incidence of patients developing a bloodstream infection as a consequence of their UTI isn't common, but it's not unheard of. And the cost, in 2009, Douglas Scott estimated that the direct medical cost per cowdy was between $862 and $1,007. And earlier in 2000, Sanjay Saint had estimated that bacteremic UTI had cost about $2,800 each U.S. to the system. Slide 13. Cowdy are sometimes discussed as if they're merely a nuisance, but they have been associated with increased mortality. It's estimated the cowdy cause or contribute to more than 13,000 deaths each year in the U.S. And the crude unadjusted mortality for patients with cowdy in the latest INIC report was 7.3%. And in a 1982 study that prospectively monitored hospital patients, the odds ratio for death among those with cowdy compared to those without was 2.8 after adjusting for age and severity of illness, duration of catheterization, and other factors. And as far as bacteremic UTI goes, Brian and Reynolds found that mortality attributed to bacteremic UTI was 12.7%. And they found that most of these deaths occurred in high-risk patients who had poor prognoses because of underlying illness. Slide 14. Cowdy constitute a large reservoir of multidrug-resistant organisms that create a risk for cross-infection. And both symptomatic cowdy and asymptomatic bacteriuria also promote inappropriate use of antimicrobials. Slide 15. Cowdy is an important quality indicator for organizations and for payers. The Joint Commission has a new national patient safety goal in 2012 that obliges hospitals to implement evidence-based practices to prevent cowdy, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has an action plan goal to reduce cowdy by 25%. And the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in the U.S. is going to begin publicly reporting cowdy rates next year through its inpatient quality reporting program. And the reports will be based on data that's currently being gathered by infection preventionists here in the U.S. in accordance with NHSN criteria. So it's hoped that this public reporting is going to be a better incentive than non-payment was to motivate hospitals to invest in cowdy prevention. I think it's widely agreed that non-payment for cowdy hasn't had any financial impact on hospitals, and so it hasn't really been a great motivator. Slide 16. In fact, this finding of little financial impact was supported by Grace Lee and her colleagues, who conducted an interrupted time series analysis to compare the rates of change of cowdy before and after the CMS policy was implemented. And they used VAP, or ventilator-associated pneumonia, as a negative control, since pneumonia wasn't a CMS-targeted infection. And what they found is that the decreasing rates of cowdy were observed well before the CMS policy was implemented, and there was no evidence that the CMS non-reimbursement policy had a measurable effect on infection rates. And the author's interpretation was that attention was already focused on HAI prevention before the disincentives, and that the financial stake for hospitals was low. Slide 17. So lastly, about the importance, cowdy are actually important nurse-sensitive outcomes. And if you're trying to develop an improvement program and you're trying to involve a lot of nurses, this is important to know. Cowdy are thought to be more highly related to the quantity and quality of nursing care than to medical care institutional characteristics. And they're endorsed as a nursing-sensitive outcome by the National Quality Forum. And the link between nurse staffing and burnout and cowdy was recently demonstrated by Jeannie Simiotti and her colleagues, they linked nurse survey data with HAI data from Pennsylvania hospitals, where the incidence of UTI was 8.6 per 1,000 patients. And what they found was that a 10% decrease in a hospital's composition of high burnout nurses was associated with a decrease of 0.82 UTIs per 1,000 patients after controlling for staffing and nurse characteristics and hospital characteristics. So the link has been made. There aren't a lot of studies, but there are some. So slide 18. Now I'm going to talk about definitions of Cowdy. So by some definitions, simply having a catheter and having bacteria or yeast in your urine constitutes a Cowdy. And this is especially common in research because it's an objective measure. But it's important to distinguish between symptomatic UTI and asymptomatic bacteriuria because while the symptomatic infection requires treatment, the asymptomatic does not, and it's relatively common. Slide 19. Normally, as you know, urine is sterile, but asymptomatic bacteriuria or the presence of bacteria in a person's urine is not uncommon. The prevalence in women of childbearing age is 2%. In elderly men, it's 6%. And in elderly women, it's 18%. And up to a quarter of institutionalized elderly men and up to half of institutionalized elderly women have asymptomatic bacteriuria. And in patients with catheters, it's even more common. 8% per day acquire bacteriuria during the first week that they have their catheters. And by 30 days, virtually 100% of patients with catheters are bacteriuric. But few of these patients have signs or symptoms of infection. And there's a widely quoted study that found that more than 90% of patients with catheters and bacteria in their urine were asymptomatic. And also, there are a few signs of asymptomatic bacteriuria. A study in trauma ICU patients found that there's no association between fever or leukocytosis and bacteriuria. Slide 20. Routine screening and treatment for asymptomatic bacteriuria is not recommended, except for pregnant women or patients undergoing urological procedures or urological surgery. And this recommendation includes catheterized patients. So treatment for asymptomatic bacteriuria in catheterized patients is not recommended, except for women with asymptomatic bacteriuria that persists 48 hours after their catheters are removed. That's a slightly newer recommendation. But the recommendations not to treat are not widely adhered to, and in order to encourage adherence, it's been suggested that non-treatment of asymptomatic bacteriuria should be a national quality performance measure. And NHSN has reinforced the distinction between asymptomatic bacteriuria and symptomatic UTI by removing asymptomatic bacteriuria from its definition of Cowdy in 2009. So now there are NHSN criteria for symptomatic UTI and bacteremic UTI. Slide 21. So the current NHSN definition for symptomatic UTI in adults includes symptoms and a positive culture and a determination that the infection was healthcare associated. So in order for it to be healthcare associated, all elements of the infection had to be present together on or after hospital day 3, and all elements must have occurred together, at least within one calendar day. And in order for it to be catheter associated, the patient must have had an indwelling catheter in place for more than 2 calendar days when all elements of the UTI criteria were first present together, and it must have been in place on the day of the UTI or the day before. Slide 22. So at least one symptom has to be present. I won't list them, but they're there. And if there must, there has to be a positive culture, either 100,000 colony-forming units per mil with no more than 2 species of microbes, or between 1,000 and 100,000, and with a positive urinalysis for either leukocyte esterase or nitrates or pus or microbes on Gram stain. Slide 23. The current NHSN definition of UTI for adults also includes asymptomatic bacteremic UTI. So the criteria to meet this definition are the absence of symptoms, fever, or suprapubic or costovertebral angle tenderness or urgency or frequency or dysuria, and a positive urine culture and a positive blood culture with a matching uropathogen. And this, the logic of this designation, this ABUTI designation, has been questioned because there is scant evidence that patients with that asymptomatic bacteriuria develop secondary BSIs. And it's also possible that patients with a bloodstream infection from another source, like a central line, could also have, incidentally, bacteria in their urine. But it doesn't meet the, it doesn't meet the need for us to capture through surveillance CAUTI in patients who can't communicate their symptoms because they're intubated or unconscious. So it has some utility. Slide 24. Next, I'm going to briefly review the pathogenesis of CAUTI. Slide 25. Indwelling urinary catheters interfere with normal barriers to infection in the urinary tract. So when there's a catheter in place, the urethral meatus is open, the urethra is not flushed by a urine stream, and the bladder could be incompletely emptied, and there's mechanical trauma to the urethra and the bladder. And the pathways for bacteria to enter catheterized bladder have been described as two different paths, either extraluminal or intraluminal. And the extraluminal path is said to account for the majority of CAUTI, and in one study, there was no difference between men and women in which way the bacteria entered, but other studies have found a difference. Slide 26. The extraluminal path is thought to be the mechanism of infection for a majority of bacteriuria episodes in women, and the fecal flora colonize the periurethral area and enter the urinary tract either during insertion of the catheter or by capillary action once it's in place. And this can happen, but it doesn't always happen. So periurethral colonization doesn't routinely lead to bacteriuria. When it does, it takes more than 72 hours. The intraluminal path is thought to be the mechanism of infection for a majority of guys. And the cross-contamination of the drainage system occurs often by a handling by healthcare workers who haven't cleaned their hands, and the bacteria ascend to the bladder. The same bacteria that were in the drainage bag can be found in the bladder after about 24 to 48 hours, and this is very common in patients who aren't on antimicrobials, and it quickly escalates. In the bladder, the concentration of microbes can increase from 100 colony-forming units to more than 100,000 per mil in less than 24 hours. Slide 27. Biofilms also play a role in catheter-associated UTIs. Biofilms develop when bacteria attach to and coat the catheter surface, and Proteus and Pseudomonas in particular are prone to forming biofilms. The bacteria secrete an extracellular matrix, and then the patient's own urinary proteins and salts become incorporated into the matrix. And it's known that bacteria within the biofilm grow more slowly than planktonic bacteria, but they do grow in the biofilm. And planktonic bacteria are those that are floating around freely in the urine. Biofilms create two problems. The bacterial cultures of the planktonic bacteria may or may not reflect what's growing in the biofilm, so it's difficult to identify the infecting organism. Perhaps more importantly, the presence of the biofilm inhibits the activity of antimicrobials and the patient's own host defenses against the bacteria in the biofilm. Slide 28. Researchers have examined the composition and dimensions of natural biofilms that they found on indwelling bladder catheters. They use scanning electron microscopes. And in one study, where the patients were either residents in a spinal cord unit or clinic patients with long-term catheters, many of them had bacteriuria. That study showed that the silicone catheters that were in place for between 3 and 83 days, there was a biofilm on 44 out of 50 of them. And 75% of them, biofilms, were of mixed bacterial communities, up to four organisms. So they did not find a relationship between the duration of catheterization and the extent of the biofilm formation, but the biofilms were thicker and more developed on the inside of the surface of the catheters than on the outside. And the layers of bacterial cells were up to 400 cells deep in the matrix. So other studies have suggested that the biofilms aren't visible on catheters that have been indwelling for less than 7 days. So there may be a window there. Slide 29. In patients with short-term catheters, most cowdy are caused by single organisms, and the most common cause of organism is E. coli, which comprises about 21% of the infections, and the second most common is Candida albicans, about 14% of infections, and Pseudomonas, Klebsiella, and Enterococcus faecium comprise 10, 8, and 6% of the causative organisms, respectively. And hematogenous seeding of the urinary tract has been documented. So in these cases, bacteria that are present in the bloodstream, say if a person has endocarditis, are subsequently also found in the patient's urine. In slide 30, duration of catheterization is a primary risk factor for cowdy. Other risk factors are female gender, not having systemic antibiotics on board, positive urine, urethral meatal culture results, microbial colonization in the drainage bag, catheters inserted outside the OR, and catheter care violations. And patients who have a rapidly fatal underlying illness or who are older, who have diabetes or an elevated serum creatinine when they're catheterized. So slide 31, let's move on and address the guidelines for cowdy prevention. Slide 32, many expert groups have promulgated guidelines for cowdy prevention, and I've referenced them on the slide only so that you can have quick access if you want them to. I won't go through all the alphabet soup of the different organizational names, but I will focus on the most recent 2010, published in 2010, written in 2009, the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee of the CDC, and I'll refer to this group as HICPAC. Slide 33. Although there are many guidelines, there's not a lot of research evidence to base recommendations on. For example, the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America and the Infectious Diseases Society of America guideline, there are only 3 positive recommendations and 4 prescriptions that are based on good evidence from more than one properly randomized controlled trial. And in the HICPAC guideline that we're going to be looking at more closely, there are no 1A recommendations at all for acute care settings. And a 1A recommendation for HICPAC is something that is supported by a high to moderate quality evidence. So nonetheless, across all these guidelines, there are 3 unanimous recommendations to prevent cowdy. Minimize catheter use and duration, insert catheters using aseptic technique and sterile equipment, maintain a closed sterile drainage system, and I'll discuss these in detail shortly, but let's look first at the contentious issues between the guidelines, and there are very few. Growth in the evidence base, even though it's been minimal, has resulted in some newer recommendations over the past decade or so. So there have been specific strategies listed to remove the catheter as soon as possible, like automatic stop orders are now recommended. And the use of a portable bladder ultrasound scanner to rule out retention is fairly new as well. And there are now silver alloy catheters are now recommended for use in select patients, as are antimicrobial impregnated catheters in select patients. And pre-connected catheters with their collection systems with sealed junctions are also recommended. And there are very few divergent recommendations across all the guidelines that I listed. Hydrophilic catheters are weakly recommended for intermittent catheterization by HICPAC, but they're disapproved of by IDSA. And for meatal cleaning, cleaning the urethral meatus before inserting a catheter, the England National Health Service recommends sterile saline, but HICPAC makes no recommendation. And if the closed catheter system is violated, the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America recommends replacing the collection system. But HCPAC recommends replacing both the catheter and the collection system, which makes sense if you've got sealed junctions. So really, other than those, there's wide agreement between guidelines on how to prevent CAUTI. Slide 35. But despite the uniformity of these recommendations, the CAUTI prevention practices have not been widely adopted by U.S. hospitals. And in 2008, we surveyed non-federal hospitals that participate in NHSN, and 250 of the 441 hospitals that we invited provided data on 415 ICUs. And what we found was that there was no widely used CAUTI prevention policy. We asked them, does your ICU have a written policy in place for bladder ultrasound or for condom catheters or for stop orders or for nurse-initiated urinary catheter discontinuation? And fewer than half of the ICUs, 42% on the bottom line of that table, had at least one policy in place. And less than a quarter of them, 22%, tracked compliance with their policy, and only a handful, six, of those who tracked compliance had really good compliance, like greater than 95%. So slide 36, we looked for things that might be associated with having adopted a CAUTI prevention policy, and two things were hospital size and access to key decision makers. So ICUs in hospitals, big hospitals with more than 500 beds, were half as likely to have adopted a CAUTI prevention policy than smaller hospitals. And in hospitals where the ICU director always had access to key decision makers, the odds of adopting CAUTI policy was more than twice that of hospitals where the director had less access. So we did not find any significant difference in CAUTI rates for ICUs with at least one policy in place compared to those with no policy. And we were unable to assess the association between compliance with CAUTI policy and CAUTI rates because so few ICUs track compliance. So although guidelines are available and recommendations are consistent, the challenge is in uptake and implementation. So let's move on to slide 37. Let's review the strategies for CAUTI prevention. Slide 38. The strategies can be grouped into four principles: minimize catheter use and duration, insert catheters using aseptic technique and sterile equipment, maintain a closed sterile drainage system, and apply administrative controls. I will summarize all the recommendations from the HCPAC guideline that address CAUTI prevention in adults with short-term catheters. The HCPAC guideline is recent, it's detailed, it specifies priorities, what strategies to implement ahead of others. And I'll supplement the HCPAC guideline recommendations with recommendations from some pertinent Cochrane reviews that I found. So slide 39. HCPAC uses a four-tier recommendation scale, but all the recommendations that we're concerned about for prevention in adults are classified as either 1B or 2. So a grade 1B recommendation is a strong recommendation supported by low-quality evidence, or an accepted practice supported by low to very low-quality evidence. And a grade 2 recommendation is a weak recommendation supported by any quality evidence. And I've added an asterisk to those recommendations that the HCPAC guidelines authors consider to be a priority for implementation. Slide 40. The first principle is to minimize catheter use and duration. Slide 41. The key recommendation is to only use catheters when they're indicated. So acceptable indications for use are for acute urinary retention, for frequent accurate measurement of urine, postoperatively in selected procedures such as urological surgery or surgery with a prolonged duration, or if the patient's anticipated to receive large volume infusions during surgery, or if the patient will need intraoperative monitoring of their urine output. It's also acceptable for sacral or perineal wound healing in incontinent patients, for prolonged immobilization such as when the patient has an unstable spine or a pelvic fracture, or for patient comfort at the end of life if the patient or their family asks for it. Slide 42. The HCPAC recommendations are to minimize urinary catheter use and duration of use in all patients, but they particularly want us to focus on those patients who are at higher risk for CAUTI or mortality from catheterization, such as women and the elderly and patients with impaired immunity. And the specific recommendations are to avoid using catheters to manage incontinence and to use catheters in operative patients only as necessary. And you can refer back to the indications that they gave in the last slide. Slide 43, one alternative to indwelling catheters is to use a condom catheter in cooperative male patients, and that's a grade 2 recommendation. Using suprapubic catheters as an alternative to indwelling catheters is an unresolved issue. There is a Cochrane review and meta-analysis completed by Neil Weiss and Vandenbroek, which was updated in 2009, and they found that for short-term bladder drainage, meaning up to 14 days in adults in hospitals, compared to patients with a suprapubic catheter, patients with urethral catheters had more bacteriuria, more frequent recatheterization, more discomfort. So even though it's hard to know if bacteriuria is clinically significant at all, that's still quite compelling. But they didn't have any cost data, and there was no information about possible complications or adverse effects from suprapubic catheter insertion. Slide 44, another alternative to an indwelling catheter is intermittent straight catheterization. It's sometimes called in-and-out catheterization, and it's recommended for patients with spinal cord injury or bladder emptying dysfunction, and it's a grade 2 recommendation. And HCPAC specifies that it should be performed at regular intervals so that there's no bladder overdistension, and clinicians should use a portable ultrasound device to assess the urine volume before doing the in-and-out catheter. So they also describe that there should be in-house protocols for the use of the ultrasound device, establishing indications for its use. Staff should be trained on how to use the scanner, and there should be protocols to ensure that the equipment is properly cleaned and disinfected between patients. So the same Cochrane review I referred to earlier looked at trials of different approaches to short-term bladder drainage in adults in hospitals, and they found that compared to patients with an indwelling catheter, those with intermittent catheters had fewer cases of bacteriuria. But they also found that intermittent catheterization may be more costly than indwelling. Slide 45. In order to minimize the duration of use, the HCPAC guidelines recommend removing catheters as soon as possible postoperatively, preferably within 24 hours. And that is a priority recommendation. And the reason that there needs to be a concerted effort to get catheters out is because they get forgotten. It's not uncommon for physicians to be unaware that a patient's catheterized. In a study by Sanjay Saint, they gave physicians a list of patients on their service, and they asked, does this patient have a catheter or not? And on average, physicians were unaware of catheterization for 28% of catheterized patients and 41% of inappropriately catheterized patients. So catheterization was more likely to be appropriate if the respondents, the physicians, were aware of the catheter. So it is necessary to take action at the system level to ensure that the catheters are removed as soon as they're not needed. And these could include reminders, so either stickers on patients' charts or electronic alerts to remind the team that the patient has a catheter, or automatic stop orders so that catheters are removed, say, at 24 hours or 72 hours unless there's a specific order to retain them. Or a facility or unit could establish nurse-driven protocols for removal of catheters if the patient meets some predetermined criteria. And there isn't a lot of evidence about clamping catheters prior to removal, but since it hasn't been found to improve outcomes, it's considered unnecessary. Slide 46. Cochrane Review by Griffiths and Fernandez, which was updated in 2009, looked at the best strategies for getting short-term catheters out of adults. And they found that following urological procedures or surgeries, removing the catheter at midnight instead of in the morning resulted in longer times to the first void, which is a good outcome, larger volumes at the first void, shorter lengths of stay, and no difference in the need for recatheterization. So studies that compared removing the catheter sooner rather than later, for instance, immediately versus 1 or 2 days, or 1 day versus 3 days, or 1 day versus 5 days, overall, in the 13 studies that they included, for catheters, patients whose catheters were removed sooner rather than later, there was a lower risk for infection and shorter length of stay, but there were higher risks of voiding problems. And they found that there wasn't enough evidence to assess the effects of clamping, and not enough evidence to assess the effects of using alpha adrenergic blockers on the incidence of recatheterization. Slide 47. The second principle for preventing CAUTI is to insert the catheters using aseptic technique and sterile equipment. Slide 48. Concerning the choice of what type of catheter to insert, the HCPCS guideline recommends using the smallest bore possible and using antimicrobial or antiseptic impregnated catheters only if a comprehensive strategy to reduce CAUTI isn't working. And a Cochrane review on this topic by Shum and Lam, which was updated in 2010, found that compared to standard catheters, silver alloy catheters significantly reduced the incidence of asymptomatic bacteriuria at 1 week by half and at 2 weeks by 36%. And this review also found that compared to standard catheters, antibiotic impregnated catheters lowered the rate of asymptomatic bacteriuria at 1 week by half or more than half, but there was no information about the impact of either type of catheter on symptomatic UTI and no information on cost or development of resistance in the long term. So there's still a lot to be learned about these catheters. Slide 49. The HCPCS guideline makes a priority recommendation to use aseptic technique and sterile equipment for catheter insertion. So this includes using sterile gloves, sterile drape, sterile sponges, and sterile lubricant. And as I mentioned previously, the jury is still out on whether an antiseptic or sterile water should be used to clean the periurethral area before insertion. There is wide agreement that the catheter should be secured to prevent movement and urethral traction. Slide 50. The third principle for preventing CAUTI is to maintain a closed sterile drainage system. Slide 51. Maintaining a closed sterile drainage system is a priority recommendation. And in order to keep it closed, they recommend using catheters that come from the manufacturer with pre-connected sealed junctions between the catheter itself and the collecting system. And they also recommend that if the system becomes disconnected or contaminated or it's leaking, that it should be replaced. Clinicians should perform hand hygiene immediately before and after any manipulation of catheter or apparatus, and they should use standard precautions during any manipulation. Also, they should sample urine aseptically, taking small volumes from the sampling port with a sterile syringe after disinfecting the port with alcohol or another disinfectant. And slide 52. Another priority recommendation is to maintain an unobstructed flow of urine, and to do this, nurses should keep the collecting bag below the level of the bladder. They shouldn't allow the collection bag to touch the floor, and they should avoid kinks and dependent loops in the collection tubing. And nurses or technicians should also empty the drainage bag regularly using a separate container for each patient and not allowing the spigot of the collection bag to touch the collecting container. And this recommendation is counterintuitive, but nurses should not do any special urethral needle care, so not sort of routinely cleansing the patient's perineum with soap or betadine or anything, only routine cleaning during their daily bath. Other practices to avoid are routine irrigation, routine catheter changes, unless the catheter is obstructed, and routine screening of catheterized patients for asymptomatic bacteriuria is, as I mentioned earlier, is not recommended. Slide 53. As far as antimicrobials are concerned, the guidelines recommend against using systemic prophylaxis routinely, but methionine for urinary antisepsis is an unresolved issue. They also recommend against treating asymptomatic bacteriuria routinely, and although it is true the patients who are on antimicrobials for other reasons develop bacteriuria less frequently than those who are not on antimicrobials, those patients quickly are colonized with resistant organisms and bacteriuria recurs. So antimicrobial prophylaxis and treatment of asymptomatic bacteriuria is not recommended because of the cost and the potential for developing resistance and the changes in the gut microbiome that can lead to C. difficile infection. So in some populations, treating asymptomatic bacteriuria has been found to improve outcomes, and these are the exceptions to the rule. So patients who are pregnant, patients undergoing urological procedures or surgery, including renal transplant. Treating symptomatic UTI is generally recommended, and that's a clinical decision, but it has been suggested that the catheter should be changed, especially if it's been in place for more than a week, and urine and blood culture should be taken before treatment started for symptomatic UTI. And instilling antimicrobials in a drainage bag is not helpful for reducing the risk of CAUTI. Slide 54. A second review by Neil Weiss and Vandenbroek, which was updated in 2009, examined whether certain antibiotic policies are better than others for preventing CAUTI in adults. But they included only six trials, and they found that compared to giving antibiotics when it was clinically indicated, giving prophylaxis reduced the incidence of symptomatic CAUTI in female patients after abdominal hysterectomy in one trial. So more research is needed in that area. They also found that compared to giving antibiotics for a positive culture, giving prophylaxis reduced the incidence of bacteriuria among some patients. But again, it's difficult to determine the clinical significance of reducing bacteriuria. Slide 55. Next, we'll talk about the fourth principle for preventing CAUTI, and that is to apply administrative controls. Slide 56. The HCPAC recommendations focus on education and protocols and supplies. So their priority recommendation is to ensure that only properly trained people insert and maintain catheters. And this includes providing periodic in-service training. And my recommendation, not theirs, but mine, would be to focus your educational efforts on operating room and emergency room staff because most catheters are inserted there, 62% in the OR and 11% in the ER. And the catheters that are placed in the ER are maintained for a significantly longer duration than the catheters placed in the OR. So, but as I said, that's not a HCPAC recommendation, and your hospital may be different from the academic medical center where the research was done. But it would make sense to use your education resources widely and target those areas and those clinicians who do the insertions. Facilities should also provide protocols for catheter use and insertion and maintenance and removal, and they should ensure that supplies are readily available for use at the point of use. Slide 57. The HCPAC group recommended implementing quality improvement programs, and they also suggested that hospitals consider conducting surveillance for CAUTI. And if a facility does decide to monitor CAUTI rates, administrators should ensure that there's a sufficient number of trained personnel to conduct the surveillance and that there is technological support and that a standard surveillance methodology should be used. Slide 58. The HCPAC guideline makes a priority recommendation to provide performance feedback to clinicians and administrators. So you can provide feedback on CAUTI prevention processes or on CAUTI outcomes. So some examples of process measures are the device utilization ratio, the percent of persons who've been trained, the percent of catheters with an appropriate indication documented, the percent of catheters with documented insertion and removal dates, or maybe the percentage of catheters removed within, say, 24 or 48 hours of surgery stop time. And as an outcome measure, HCPAC recommends monitoring and feeding back Cowdy rates per 1,000 catheter days. There's no grade assigned to this recommendation. It's included in the quality improvement section. But Cowdy rates could also be reported as rates per 100 patient days or rates per 100 catheters inserted if you wanted. Slide 59. A Cochrane review in 2012 looked at the effectiveness of different interventions to improve healthcare professionals' adherence to infection control guidelines for preventing bacteremias and pneumonias and cowdies. And they concluded there was insufficient evidence to determine anything with certainty, but that there are two types of interventions that warranted further study, the first being educational interventions that consist of more than one element and that are administered repeatedly over time, and the second being employing dedicated personnel who are focused on a particular aspect of care. For an example I could think of would be an ER tech who was specially trained to insert and secure urinary catheters. Slide 60. So applying administrative controls, such as providing education and supplies and establishing protocols, is recommended. But the guidelines really don't address how to change your institutional culture so that it supports Cowdy prevention efforts. So there have been some good qualitative studies that have identified institutional characteristics that are associated with successful infection reduction. And so I'll just go over those briefly. Institutions where infection prevention processes are hardwired into daily activities and the data is fed back to clinicians who carry out the processes tend to be successful at HAI reduction. And institutions where local data is used as evidence to influence clinicians and other stakeholders are successful. And where strong personal relationships exist, those institutions are successful. And institutions that have a collective focus on patient safety in an affirming emotional context have been successful. And also, intrinsically motivated champions or clinicians who don't necessarily work in infection prevention, but who have an interest in HAI and a passion for patient safety and can be recruited to plan and shepherd a Cowdy prevention initiative may lead to some success. And research also suggests that it's very important that if there's any ambiguity in national guidelines, that needs to be clarified at the facility level so that clinicians know who's responsible for guideline adherence and what tasks need to be accomplished and what methods they should employ and what exceptions might be appropriate for them. So slide 61, there are also key leadership behaviors that are exhibited by leaders at hospitals where HAI prevention practices are the norm, and I won't list these except to say that the Sanjay Saint study did find that infection preventionists and hospital epidemiologists often played an even more important leadership role than high-level executives at hospitals. And so these key leadership behaviors are important no matter who the leader is and no matter what office they hold at the hospital. Slide 62. Next, I'm going to describe some challenges in Cowdy surveillance. So the basic challenge is deciding whether or not to conduct surveillance for Cowdy. So slide 63. The Joint Commission allows each organization to decide whether Cowdy is a priority for surveillance or not. And I suspect that many organizations decide not to monitor Cowdy for two reasons. The first is that programs to reduce catheter use can be effective, but they're also resource intensive. They cost a lot of money and time. And the second is that a single Cowdy is not as costly as a bacteremia or a pneumonia or a surgical site infection, and Cowdy are rarely cause sentinel events. So Cowdy becomes a low priority for surveillance, and if Cowdy is granted priority, it's challenging to decide which units to monitor. If Cowdy is your priority, then since neurological patients and patients undergoing rehab typically have the highest Cowdy risk, these units should probably be monitored. Targeting ICUs instead of wards may not be wise, given that county rates in wards and can be similar to ICUs, and as well as the device utilization ratio is similar in wards and ICUs, so that's a challenging decision to make. Slide 64. In county surveillance, denominator matters. Mark Oliver Wright and his team observed a paradoxical increase in their county rates when a program at their hospital was successful in reducing catheter usage. So their device utilization ratio decreased from 0.36 to 0.28, and their county rates decreased significantly from 28 to 23 per 10,000 patient days. But when they measured it as infections per 1,000 catheter days, their catheter rates increased from 7.79 to 8.28 per 1,000 catheter days. And this suggests that their catheter usage probably decreased in the lower-risk patients, and their high-risk patients still had catheters and still got infections, but since the overall catheter days had been reduced, the rates went up. So hospitals may want to consider using a patient day denominator or a number of catheters inserted as a denominator instead of catheter days, or at least in addition to catheter days. Slide 65. The numerator obviously also matters in CAUTI surveillance. Alan Stamm and his colleagues at a 1,000-bed academic medical center compared three metrics to identify infections in eight ICUs, and they used traditional surveillance by six experienced IPs using the NHSN criteria. They used an electronic surveillance system, and they used ICD-9 codes. And the denominator for the study was the number of infections found by any of those three methods. And they compared each of the three methods to a gold standard, which was infection as determined by the two physician authors. And the results suggested that traditional surveillance has better sensitivity, better positive predictive value, and better rate estimation than either of the other two methods. So even though traditional surveillance is superior, it's time-consuming. So if we could possibly conduct CAUTI surveillance using computer algorithms to find data in the that already exist in the electronic health record, that would be desirable. So slide 66. Tim Landers and Dr. Larson's group at Columbia developed seven computer algorithms to try to identify CAUTI using electronic data. So they used UTI diagnosis from ICD-9 codes, urine culture results from the clinical data warehouse, either high numbers of organisms or lower numbers of organisms plus pyuria, or either of those two. They used culture results with fever, which was the presence or absence of fever was electronically available in the electronic health record. Different culture levels with fever or either culture level with fever. So what they found was that the ICD-9 symptom codes were very infrequently used. In fact, fewer than 0.1% of cases had any single CAUTI symptom code associated with them, and so they're of limited value, likely, for CAUTI surveillance. And they also found that the sensitivity of ICD-9 codes compared to criteria 7, which was culture plus fever, was only 55.6%, so that may also be of limited value for surveillance if you're using a CAUTI definition that includes symptoms. And they weren't able to compare the rates of CAUTI using these algorithms compared to the rates of CAUTI determined by traditional surveillance, but they did demonstrate that the electronic data can be useful for surveillance as long as you know, the decision makers know, what the limitations of the data are. Slide 67. I'll finish by listing some of the gaps in the evidence that CAUTI that guides CAUTI prevention practices. Slide 68. Further research is needed to assess the utility of electronic data for CAUTI surveillance and reporting. We need studies that target symptomatic CAUTI as the outcome rather than asymptomatic bacteriuria. We need research into the use of condom catheters in acute care. Since most of what we know is from long-term care settings, we need research into the complications of suprapubic catheter use, and we need a better understanding of the context in which automatic stop orders or nurse-directed protocols can reduce inappropriate catheter use. And we also need evidence about whether antiseptic or sterile water should be used for periurethral cleansing during catheter insertion. And we need more information about how non-pathogenic strains of bacteria might interfere with pathogenic strains to reduce the risk of CAUTI. And finally, we need evidence on the effects of spatial separation of patients with catheters and colonized urine from non-infected patients. Slide 69. So to review, strategies for CAUTI prevention are to minimize catheter use and duration, and that includes insertion only for appropriate indications and remove as soon as possible. Number two, insert catheters using aseptic technique and sterile equipment. Number three, maintain a closed sterile drainage system, and that includes ensuring unobstructed urine flow and high adherence to hand hygiene policies. And number four is apply administrative controls, especially only trained personnel should insert and care for catheters. Slide 70, I'd really like to thank my mentor, Dr. Larson, for her tireless support of my development as a nurse researcher, and I am supported by a pre-doctoral fellowship from the National Institute of Nursing Research. I have used up most of our time, but I'm happy to take your questions.
Okay, Lori, thank you for a very well-organized and thorough review of sort of the state of the science of CAUTI and prevention strategies, et cetera. I have a number of questions here, but I do see that our time is up. So what I would suggest is that if any of you have questions, please email info@webertraining.com, and Lori will be, Paul Weber will be happy to forward your questions to Lori for any answers that you have. So thank you again, and thank you, Paul, for, as usual, a very stimulating conversation. Paul, did you want to add anything else?
With that, I was just basking in the glow of your appreciation. Thank you, Dr. Larson. I would just note on the last two slides that I put in that there are some teleclasses that are coming up. The next two teleclasses are both freebies and are both broadcast live from infection control conferences. The CHIGA Canada conference with Sir Liam Donaldson and the APIC conference with two speakers, Stephen Bach and somebody whose name I can't pronounce in Japanese, but it's on infection control during disasters. Both of those are free registration, and even if you can't attend the live version of them, register for them because that gives you access to the online recordings. And lastly, if I may, I would just like to acknowledge our patron sponsors, Virax Technologies and the World Health Organization, Clean Care is Safer Care. Their support is invaluable. So thank you, Dr. Larson, and Lori, thank you as well. And Dr. Larson, unless you have final comments, then we can wrap up.
Okay, well, let's wrap up, and I will email my questions or talk to Lori.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Paul.
Bye.
Bye.